May it please the Court, Molly Odom for Desmond Jones. Mr. Jones argues on appeal that the District Court committed reversible error when it held that his prior conviction for escape under 18 U.S.C. Section 751A was a qualifying crime of violence as defined under the guidelines Section 4B1.2, and that's under the residual clause, which looks to whether the conduct presents a serious potential risk of physical injury to another. He recognized that this court held in United States v. Hughes that a Section 751A escape is a crime of violence under 4B1.2. However, he argues that his case is distinguishable from Hughes because his escape was from a halfway house. That distinction is important because in Hughes, the panel in that case at footnote 6, which is the footnote where the court cites the defendant's charging instrument in Hughes. This is at 676. They're noting that Mr. Hughes escaped from a detention facility. The next paragraph is a one-sentence standalone, it's just a standalone sentence in footnote 6 that says, quote, "We do not decide whether the other crimes set out in Section 751A are also violent felonies." End quote. So the issue Mr. Jones raises with regards to his absconding from a halfway house is open and squarely before the court and is not, as the government argues, foreclosed.
So you're distinguishing Hughes factually only. You're not saying there's a legal distinction between the Armed Career Criminal Act and this guideline?
That's correct. It's based on the conduct under the residual clause and whether looking to the charging instrument, whether the government has shown that the conduct involves
right.
that risk.
But the conduct argument might be stronger for your client than it would have been in Hughes.
That's correct, and that's what's distinguishable.
Well,
and
not because factually we know it's a halfway house, but because I'm asking you whether do you know – are you conceding that case law that interprets crime of violence for the Armed Career Criminal Act is applicable and controlling legally for purposes of 4B1.2?
Yes.
That's your position?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So you're not relying on this court's en banc Charles decision or the Lipscomb decision, cases that do seem to look at the charged conduct?
No. I am saying under 4B1.2, there is the residual clause, which under the modified categorical approach, one does look at the charged conduct.
But you would say that that's done under the Armed Career Criminal Act definition of crimes of violence also?
Yes.
You're drawing no distinction.
No, and courts, the circuits that have addressed this issue, they've addressed it both under 924E and 4B1.2. And they're using the same modified categorical analysis.
Well, there are lots of complexities, and we may have created the complexities, or Congress, whoever it is, that has had such difficulty putting meaning to the phrase crime of violence. But I would one layer of difficulty is the recent DeCamp decision.
Yes.
Seems to foreclose modified categorical inquiry in cases like 751, where the statute doesn't have disjunctive separate sections.
Yes.
So if we can't use the modified, then we get down to a choice of either categorical, which I think is what Hughes did. And if we apply Hughes, then you still lose, even if there's a split in circuits.
Now, the circuits that have been addressing the statutes and looking at whether or not it has different behaviors, different conduct that's incorporated in the statute, have continued. They first looked at the statute itself to see if it qualifies as a crime of violence. And then if it has various behaviors, including behaviors that would not present this potential risk. I'm sorry.
Aren't we talking apples and oranges? Because DeCamps involved a specified crime, burglary.
Right.
And so we look at what is the generic definition of burglary. That's the first step. Then you look at whether it's a divisible statute or not. And we don't have that here. We've got the residual clause.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure.
Under the case law states that under the residual clause, the court, and that's still good law, the court looks to the charging instrument to see if the conduct presents a risk. That's still good law. You don't look at the...
Not under the ACCA, I don't think you do. I think you look at, under the ACCA, I think you look at the statutory offense, and then you decide, right, based on Begay, whether it meets the requirements, the residual,
right,
clause, keeping, bearing in mind the antecedent specified crimes, whereas I think the commission decided to go a whole different way after they saw the train wreck under the ACCA.
But so using that scenario, you have, under the analysis of Begay, the statute here is still overbroad because it includes conduct that ranges from escape.
What
from
I'm trying to tell you, I think you're missing a bet, okay, here by tying this to the ACCA.
Yeah.
Okay.
Legally.
And just sticking with the 4B1.2.
Yes.
All right. I see what you're saying. I do.
Even under the ACCA, I think you're restricting what the various Supreme Court decisions have been dealing with.
I see. I'm now on the same page. You're right. The cases that all the circuits that have addressed this, it was post Begay and Chambers and pre-Descamp, and I do see the point that you're taking.
Did you make the kind of analysis that the majority opinion in Chambers did about the percentage of cases that the commission has identified?
Yes. Yes. And in doing that, and in fact, I have the chart. If you don't have it before you, the Chambers chart, I can give it to the clerk to distribute. What the court did in Chambers was it looked at, following that two-part analysis in Begay, you have the let me just turn to it real quick here. So under Begay, the two-part analysis is whether the non-enumerated offense poses a potential risk of harm, and also whether it's similar in kind to the enumerated offenses. And so in Chambers, they held that a failure to appear is a form of inaction and a far cry from those enumerated offenses. In other words, it wasn't in kind. It was conduct that was purposeful, violent, and aggressive, whereas a walkaway is a passive. It's passive. And the circuits that have looked at this have agreed with that reasoning.
The indictment in this case, it doesn't say walk away, does it?
It says abscond.
It says abscond.
It says abscond. And the
I thought this was actually a failure to walk back.
Right. And when you look at that chart in Chambers.
But I was curious about that. Did this sentencing judge even have that indictment, or is that something you supplemented?
That is something that I supplemented the record with.
So it's a little awkward to be reversing the district judge based on a charging document that the district judge never saw.
My argument is that the government failed to prove that the offense necessarily, which is the Shepherd standard, that the necessarily involves the risk.
That's
of
your
harm.
Argument here.
That's my argument.
And supplemented
here.
All of a sudden gets really strong, arguably. But at the sentencing below, that didn't seem to me to be the objection that, they need to prove up the charging document.
That's correct. The defense counsel did discuss the conduct. He did discuss
true,
the
he
conduct.
True, he did, because it's in the PSR, but no one would ever say the PSR can count.
That's right. But he did not provide the court with a copy. And keeping in mind, the burden is on the government.
But he didn't ask the government to meet that burden. He just said he tried to do what you did in your brief, which is factually this is dissimilar, but there was no objection saying, wait a minute, the guideline commentary requires the charged conduct. Where's the indictment? Now we get it supplemented to us, but the district court never had that in front of it.
That's correct.
Okay.
But, however, as the government noted in its responsive brief, he did make the argument that he believed it was distinguishable because of the conduct.
When you start looking at this conduct that's extraneous, we characterize what really happened in this case, that he came back. When you start looking at that type of evidence for the characterization of something violent or not, it cuts both ways. Because, first off, there's a very high risk, of course, that other evidence may demonstrate violence and when it's not been charged.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're very concerned, more concerned with the quality of the evidence and how you're going to impose a sentence
right.
on an individual about something that comes up in the record. This stuff about he absconded, he walked away and came back, I gather that's not contested. But where does it appear in the record?
It The defense counsel did not specifically provide the document, the federal document that showed his indictment. That was supplemented to the record. Defense counsel did discuss before the court.
Well, how did you, I mean, who somebody, how did you get that information? Was it in the file?
It's a federal case. It was a federal escape, and so it is.
Can you pull that mic in front of you?
Yes. It was a federal escape, and so it is in the federal, it's on the federal docket. Just pulling the indictment from that actual federal case that had occurred earlier. The same attorney had represented him in his walk-away escape conviction.
I'm not sure I understand that.
It was a prior.
The large concern of the Supreme Court is where this path, where it takes you, is not just the efficiency and the difficulties of imposing on courts to root around, as they say, in the records. The man was charged in custody, and he breached the trust, and he walked away. Now, he didn't have to pry through the bars to get there, but he was at large, right? And,
yes.
And if he hadn't come back, he would have been subject to being arrested. He's an
right.
escaped felon.
Right.
And we have said that, and other circuits have said, that an escaped felon contains a potential for violence. I mean,
yes.
It does.
And they did. In fact, every circuit except the Ninth Circuit has held that.
I'm sorry.
Sorry.
So that's why we don't go there.
Right. But
now you want to go there because it helps you.
No, what I'm arguing is consistent with other circuits. In fact, circuits have held that a walk-away escape is not a crime of violence, but they have held that in these circumstances,
what exactly did this indictment say?
It has that he absconded from a halfway house.
Yeah.
And circuits have held that although escaping from a detention center would be a crime of violence, they have held that walk away from a halfway house is not a crime of violence.
This is a fine point here. How do we know that there are armed guards at a halfway house or not? Justice Breyer went through statistical evidence
right.
in chambers. Do we have any statistical evidence about halfway houses? I mean, how do we know
right.
generically
right.
what the risk is of
right.
serious personal injury to somebody?
Right. As I say, I do have the chambers attachment here. I've got copies if you want to look at it quickly. And I'm happy to give it to the clerk to give to you if you want to look at it while I'm talking about it. It breaks down leaving a secure facility, leaving enforcement, leaving a non-secure facility, the two least violent offenses.
How do we know a halfway house isn't a secure facility?
It can be a secure facility, but often.
Well, that's the point. We've got to look at this we have to look at generically.
But, yes, that's
so
correct.
So how do we know halfway
because
houses
within
more
that,
often than not? Or?
Right. There's a distinction. It's not the facility itself that we're looking at. It's the conduct. So, for example.
The conduct is absconding from a halfway
right,
house.
Which
it makes
one
a difference
can do,
to me whether halfway houses are most often armed
right,
guards or not.
Right, which one can do with permission. One
or
can,
not.
One,
we're not looking at the least culpable means. We're looking at
whether it shows that he necessarily committed a crime of violence.
Not the way we do it under the residual clause.
Yes. In Saul Garrott, this court did say you look to the least culpable means,
well,
and that's under 4B1.2. And it's still there. You're looking at did it necessarily show that it's a crime of violence. And you have failing to report, which is the same scenario that you're talking about, Judge Higginson, which means you have a fugitive. And the Supreme Court in chambers held that that's not a crime of violence.
You could try to, you could argue, I don't think it's persuasive, that the court ought to interpret that statute as charging multiple offenses.
Right.
But that's a pretty tough road to hoe.
Well, the Supreme Court and this court in United States v. Joyner, 496 F. 2nd, 1314, said that an escape occurred under 751 where the defendant was on a two-day furlough from a correctional institution and he failed to return.
So it does encompass that conduct. What does the statute of escape say? What's the language of the statute?
It's long.
It's long, but both this court has held
no,
that.
What's the language of the statute?
All right, I'll get it for you.
When in doubt, look at the
right. And the Supreme Court has also said that 751 includes failure to return. It does include that conduct.
While you're looking at it, can I ask you one question?
Yes.
What if, Judge Higginbotham was getting to this, you would then agree that if the charging document described sort of climbing over a wall, then it would become a crime of violence?
Yes, circuits have held that, yes.
Okay, so this will be adverse to defendants as maybe as
yes.
much or more.
Yes, that's conduct.
Okay, last question then. Let's say it says absconding from in the charging document, but that we have the factual basis that accompanied it, and it gives more detail that sounds, then what happens?
If it was part of a plea colloquy or part of a plea agreement in which the defendant admitted to it.
So Shepherd
then,
documents,
yes,
all of them.
Yes, then
even
you
though
would
the
have,
commentary says
then you could look to see if that conduct presented
okay.
a potential
okay.
risk. Yes.
That's what I thought.
Yes. And the statute, which, of course, I've had at my fingertips. And there we go.
That's only where there's a divisible, I guess this is a divisible statute.
The question is not whether or not the violence occurred here. The question, one of the threshold questions that we've dealt with before is escape. You can say this is a soft escape and it didn't go over the wall, but in some ways it's a greater breach of trust because he's been incarcerated. They entrust him to give him the point that they allowed him outside the wall. And then he takes off.
Right.
Now, nobody tells me how long was he gone.
Right, and that would be part of the, that would be.
I'm sorry?
I don't have that information.
Oh, we don't know that.
Right.
I mean, very carefully, that's what dropped out of this. He shows up 3 months later.
Right. But again, you have that same.
He's been out for 3 months as an escaped felon. Well, this
right.
doesn't have any potential for violence.
But you had that same scenario in
Why
a failure
was he in
to
there
appear?
To begin with?
Mm-hmm. You have that same scenario in a failure to appear. It's a breach of agreement. In fact, the Fifth Circuit has said in looking at absconding that failure to appear is a form of absconding or failure to show up.
No, I'm just pressing you on the difficulties that are fraught by trying to come up with this little piece of evidence which appears that the government doesn't contest that this is what happened. Well, even with that piece of information, there's a lot about this we do not know.
That's correct.
And there's a lot of differences.
And as a result,
there's a difference. You're like AWOL being AWOL and mm-hmm. the service. You're not there if the morning report says you're not there. You're not there. However, then the question is, and that's it. I mean, there's no
right. And what?
Well, Counsel, you've saved some time for rebuttal.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. It's red.
Yeah. Didn't notice. Ms. Wilson.
May it please.
Help me with how do we know how long this guy was gone for?
Well, the PSR says that he was gone for approximately 3 months.
I'm sorry?
The PSR says that he was gone for approximately 3 months. But
oh,
that's,
3 months? Oh,
yes, but that's the only information that I've seen in the record about how long
does
he was
Does that matter?
Gone. Well, apparently it matters with all due respect
well,
to Judge
I'm
Higginson.
To you is
I don't.
This information that we get that supposedly is going to be soften the characterization of the offense itself is elusive. And it's presented to me in this brief as somebody who was late getting back. And they said, well, you're too late. We're not going to let you check in. That's going away for 3 months is hardly that situation.
And
so I found what was presented to me as being extremely misleading about the conduct, and not intentional, but it's because this whole factual inquiry is fraught with hazard. There are no trial protections. It's just where somebody can find it.
And I agree.
And of course, we're not going to hear it unless it's favorable to the defendant.
Well, I agree. The record did say that.
What was he doing during the 3 months he was out there?
I don't know.
Was he taking drugs?
We don't know.
Did he have a drug problem?
There were prior convictions for that. But what I will say
so
is.
So for want of proof, the consequences of the prior conviction is softened. That's what happens here. But that doesn't mean it's not there.
Well, I think that's exactly what the powder keg analysis was in 1999 going forward, which is that there is an inherent risk when somebody escapes from a confined institution.
But that's difficult once you've got the Supreme Court saying failure to report.
Well, it is and it's not, and here's why. Because After the Ruiz decision in 1999, this court rejected that the defendant's arguments that it wasn't a crime of violence. And then we had Begay and Chambers. And to be quite candid, the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of Texas on two occasions came to this court post-Chambers and said essentially that walkaway escapes were not crimes of violence. In one case, the Delgado case, this court specifically rejected the government's position.
What's your argument to us? Do you say Hughes controls and we have no discretion?
That's
your position.
Under this court's precedence.
Well, what precedent?
Well, the precedent would be Hughes, that
Hughes
a prior conviction.
Armed Career Criminal Act case.
I'm sorry?
I thought Hughes was an Armed Career Criminal Act case.
Yes, but as in Hughes, this court says that it applies the law to the various
residuals. Not absolutely. We've looked at Marquez. We've other places we've said the guidelines are different. They include enumerated offenses that aren't in the ACCA. You've got the notes, the advisory notes that are part of the it's different than the ACCA.
But
we've said that.
But in Hughes, this court specifically analyzes Ruiz, which was under 4B1.2, and finds that there's no need to abrogate that decision. And the fact of the matter is, when you look at those decisions, including the non-published decisions, aside from the Miles decision, and the Miles decision is where the government conceded post-Chambers error, and this court accepted it. It was a very, very brief.
Are you familiar with this court's en banc Charles decision?
Yes, Your Honor.
And Lipscomb.
Yes.
Both those imply that the guidelines are different, and somewhat convincingly, the commentary would be law, and it would say you look at exactly what the commission told us to look at, which is charged conduct.
I understand that.
So we can't just turn a blind eye to that.
However, if you look at the totality of the court's decisions in this area, along with, let's just say, general principles of application, in this particular case, as Judge Higginson has pointed out, that in these escape situations, the fact of the matter is he has affirmatively left. He has committed affirmative, not passive conduct.
Is there statistical information regarding halfway houses like there was in Chambers?
Not as I recall exactly. I do not recall that in this record.
Not in this record. I'm just talking out there.
Well, I'm sure with the Sentencing Commission there is.
Well,
but
Justice Breyer went and looked at it. I mean, have you looked at it?
But yes, but I do think.
What does it say?
Well, obviously, I agree with what Ms. Odom said, is that the failure to report in the halfway, you typically see less risk conduct.
Is there any circuit other than us in Hughes that would say, in the guidelines context, any 751 escape is a crime of violence?
Well, Your Honor, one thing I'd like to alert you to, as Ms. Odom pointed out in her brief, there are several circuits that have gone the other way.
Right. So if we reiterate Hughes in the context of guidelines, I think we create a direct split, at least with the Seventh Circuit.
Well, and there has been some confusion about whether Hughes actually created the split.
Well, forget
I understand
Hughes,
the Lipscomb
I'm just
and
asking
all.
You one question. If we apply Hughes in the context of the guidelines here, we have a direct split with the Seventh Circuit. Is that true?
If this court were to find, to put a fine point on it, that Ruiz is not broad enough to encompass this particular behavior, then the answer would be yes. But one of the things I wanted to alert this court today is that in the Eighth Circuit, in a couple weeks, there will be an en banc argument. The case name is Tucker, and the cause number is 11-2444 and cause number 11-2489. The Eighth Circuit, the panel had held one way, and so the issues on banc now are whether a court can use the modified categorical approach on an indivisible Nebraska escape statute. And then, more germane here, possibly, is whether the defendant's conviction is a violent felony under the ACCA. The government's position in that particular case is that it is overly broad, in that particular statute and cannot
be done.
That's
an en banc position, so the Solicitor General has approved that position. So that would be binding on you, right? That's a national position the government's taking.
That's correct. But it's for that Nebraska statute. But I'd like to also add that post-DeKalb, the Department of Justice policy is that the DOJ believes that the second variant of the escape statute, which is the variant that applies here, namely escape from custody, is overly broad because it sweeps in the walk-away escapes.
Where is that department policy? When you're telling us that that's policy, how do you know that to be true? And is it anywhere? Is it a position that's been taken in an op-cert somewhere?
Because it's been communicated to me.
Okay, so you don't know that it's a position the Solicitor General's taken in cert filings or anything yet? You're just saying,
I do not know that yet for a fact. It's post-DeKalb, so it's
Department of Justice views 751 as a divisible statute?
That's correct, because of the four variants.
Interesting. Okay.
And I wanted to disclose that to the court. And so let me finish, just to make sure that the department's policy is articulated here. Variant 2 sweeps in walk-away escapes from unguarded facilities, which doesn't satisfy the risk requirement of the residual clause.
Of the ACCA or the guidelines?
This is under 751. Well, I mean,
there's a difference.
There is a difference.
I understand that, but I'm just communicating
well,
to
I'm
you.
Well, I'm asking, is that with respect to guidelines cases or Armed Career Criminal Act cases?
That would be, I would have to get back to you on that, Your Honor. I really don't want to step out of.
But that's difficult for your case and position here, then.
I understand that.
Well, are you withdrawing it?
No, I am not withdrawing it because our office position is that this court's precedent is controlling. Now,
well,
I understand what you're saying about Lipscomb.
Hughes is entirely dicta with respect to the guidelines.
I'm sorry, say that again, please.
Hughes is dicta with respect to the guidelines.
Well, but there is Ruiz. And so what we're saying is that this court has found that the escape, that someone who is under custody, that a knowing escape from federal custody constitutes a crime of violence under 4B1.2. That's what Ruiz said. The Ruiz decision was specifically discussed in Hughes. And
whatever Hughes says about the guidelines is still dicta, so.
Well, maybe so, but it is the more current published
if
case.
If we disagree with you that the ACCA applies here and therefore Hughes gives us no discretion, then the department policy would be against the position you're urging, number one.
Say that one more time, please.
If we disagree that if we disagree with you that Hughes is binding on us here, if we don't perceive that, then the department policy would be adverse to the position you're taking, correct? Then you wouldn't be arguing that a walk-away absconding case is a crime of violence.
Let me be clear on my position. I understand that in Hughes, the court was dealing with the ACCA. That's clear. I'm sorry?
The court in Hughes was dealing with what?
The ACCA.
The Armed Career Criminal
Act. Criminal Act. So, however, as I said just a moment ago, the court also was discussing its prior decision in Ruiz. And the focus in these decisions was a knowing escape from federal custody constitutes a crime of violence.
It's the powder cake concept.
Exactly.
Okay, we understand that.
Right.
Okay.
So what I'm also saying, however, is that this court's precedents in Hughes, I realize that's ACCA, but in Ruiz, as well as in some unpublished decisions, have focused on that it's the escape or the, you know, whether it's somebody's absconded or gone out of a jail or whatever, that it satisfies the risk requirement. So under the current law
in
the circuit.
If we look at the law as promulgated in the guidelines and
yeah.
we look at charge conduct, so assume we disagree with the application of Hughes, do you lose?
No.
Okay. But you don't lose even under the charge conduct. Is that because this district court didn't have that in front of it? But that would be your burden, correct?
No, we don't lose because of Ruiz.
I know. Okay.
Ruiz was decided in 99. When did the guidelines change to say, okay, forget the ACCA approach. We're going with conduct, and you can look at the, you look at the indictment. When did that come into the guidelines?
I don't know exactly what year that came in, but what I want to continue to say is that in, and I don't mean to be disrespectful to the court, but I'm just trying to make the point that the more recent decision of Hughes specifically.
Hughes is not a guidelines case. They weren't looking at the language that differs from the ACCA. And I, my question is simply, was that language in Ruiz at the time the guidelines? Ruiz had the guidelines in front of it. I don't think, I could be wrong, that that new approach was in the guidelines in 1999.
I would have to follow up on that. I'm not certain, but I do know that in Hughes, this court found no reason to abrogate Ruiz based on Chambers and Begay.
Just, but mentally, just be flexible for a minute. Put aside Ruiz and Hughes. 7 minutes left. Don't discuss Ruiz and Hughes. If we look at the guidelines and it says charged conduct, you don't disagree that as supplemented, this gentleman's charged conduct was an absconding walk-away case. Is that right?
Certainly. We agree.
So if that's the paradigm we're in, what would your position be? Not applying Hughes and Ruiz, given your knowledge of the Department of Justice's position. What would you say here?
Well, I don't, with all due respect, I don't think I can put that aside.
All right.
Because that's how it's been briefed.
Okay, let me ask this a whole different way. Let's suppose that, this is where I need some help. The Supreme Court's looked at burglary and decided, is this a violent felony? And they've decided what the generic meaning of burglary is. And then they say, well, sometimes it's going to sweep in conduct that is, and sometimes it's going to sweep in conduct that isn't. But generally speaking, it presents a serious enough risk, okay? Then let's take the crime in this case is knowingly absconding from the custody of the Bureau of Prisons by absconding from a halfway house. All right, do we look at that just as the Supreme Court looked at burglary and said, well, sometimes it's going to be violent and sometimes it's not, but on balance we think it's violent? Or do we take the least culpable means of violating it?
Well, I think what this court, I mean, the law is that there's a knowing escape from federal custody. And so this court has analyzed.
I'm just asking, how do we analyze, which paradigm do we use?
But
do
that's
we use
the one that we do use.
Which
and
paradigm?
In conjunction,
I'm asking you, as opposed to more, you know, more times than not, we're afraid that burglary presents a serious risk, or do we use that the least culpable means of violating the statute, in which case burglary would not be a violent felony? So which do we employ?
We employ the first, because the first folds into the powder keg scenario.
So when do we use the least culpable means analysis?
Well, in the least culpable means here, under this court's precedent, as I understand it, what we have is that that the escape conviction is a crime of violence because it presents a risk of serious injury. And that would include the walk away, for lack of a better word, the house.
As a pure legal question separated from the facts of this case, when do we employ the least culpable means analysis? In what kinds of cases?
Well, I think that where we are here is that's sort of a DeCamp question, where what we look first to is the categorical approach, and we determine whether a statute is divisible or indivisible. And then we go to the modified categorical approach. And
we find it's burglary.
Right.
We say, yes, it's burglary, but that's not the – there are least culpable means of committing burglary that would not be violent. But – we say categorically that burglary is a violent crime. Now, you see where I'm saying?
Yes, but we're looking at the usual case or the generic situation, and this court has.
So we do look generically and not at least culpable means.
And this court treats the escape, whether it's chiseling out or otherwise, as a crime of violence. Now,
Now I'm asking you another question. When do we use least culpable means if we don't use it in deciding if an offense is likely to cause violence or harm to somebody? When do we use least culpable means?
Well, I think that's what I think what they did, that was sort of how they approached it, perhaps a little bit in chambers, but I'd have to go back and look at that. But again, I think it tucks into the risk of the serious, of the, excuse me, the, how great is the risk of a serious injury? That's the analysis that we employ here. And thus far, this court has said that an escape from custody, and Jones was in custody. This is not a failure to report. He was actually in custody.
Your answer, I think, is, and you're refusing to adjust from it, which is fine, is we would never use least culpable means because it's categorically always crime of violence. So your answer to Judge Owen is you are not budging from the position that this is categorically always a crime of violence.
Right, and I also...
But I'm just asking you...
I'm trying to respect this court's precedence,
and
disclose
I'm,
the
and
Department
I'm,
of...
I want you to forget about this case because we've got least culpable means running throughout our cases. And she, your, the other side has talked about least culpable means this morning, and I just want you to explain for us when we use it. When do we use least culpable means? Forget this case.
Well, I don't think that what we have before us is...
I'm not asking you about what
I understand.
If you don't know, just say I don't know.
Well, it would depend on what particular case
Tell
we're
me
looking
a case
at.
Where you would use least culpable means.
I know that there are times that this court will apply the modified categorical approach, and it will find that whatever conduct falls outside, you see it a lot in the various crimes of violence cases.
That's
but
what
in,
I'm trying to explore with you.
But
when does that slip
well,
in?
Well, as this court knows, look at Rodriguez, look at the splintered opinions in that case. I mean, there's a lot of different feelings about when this type of situation gives rise to that, for lack of a better word. And there's a lot of confusion about it as well. And so I think, I don't think that there is, from what I can gather from this court's opinions, that there's just one solitary rule. I mean, that's why we have all these different statutes. That's why we have all these different guidelines, and we have to look at them because the starting point and the ending point in law is often what the particular statute or regulation or what have you says. And that was one of the big issues in DeCamp, is that some of these courts, I think it was the Ninth Circuit there, might have been the Seventh, I don't remember, but was reaching too deep in looking to the facts. And so that's why the starting point always has to be those things. I see that my time is up, but again, I've disclosed the Department of Justice's policy. However, the government, in relation to the Southern District of Texas, feels that based on this court's prior decisions, that I'm going to say Ruiz, which was not abrogated in Hughes, would ensure that Mr. Jones' conviction be upheld in all respects.
Thank you, counsel.
Start with United States versus Ensal-Garrott, where the citing the en banc decision in Charles, and this is a 4B1.2 case, the court says in Charles, offenses should only be considered a crime of violence if from the face of the indictment, the crime that was charged presents a serious potential risk of physical injury. And then now I'm quoting from Houston, which is in Ensal-Garrott. If an indictment is silent as to the offender's actual conduct, we must proceed under the assumption that his conduct constituted the least culpable act satisfying the count of conviction. And this is consistent with the Shepherd approach, is did the government's, does the charging instrument, did the reliable documents show that it necessarily is a crime of violence? That's what the court is looking
to. Let me submit to you the way I understand it.
Uh-huh.
You have a statute that's divisible, and some ways of violating the statute are a crime of violence, or let me start with the Armed Career Criminal Act, violent felony, and some are not. So then you can consult the indictment and other things to see if they were charged with this crime, which is violent felony, or this crime, which is not violent felony.
Yes.
And you look at the least culpable, that's when the least culpable means comes in the divisible statutes. We've got a divisible statute here. Now we know what he was charged with because we've got the indictment. He was charged with what he was charged with.
Yes.
Then the question becomes, is that generic, just like burglary, does that more often than not, or whatever prism you look through it, are we going to say that often enough presents a substantial enough risk that we're going to call it a crime of violence? So isn't that where we are?
Yes. And all the circuits that have addressed this have distinguished between the circumstances in Hughes where it was a walk away from a detention facility, but have also held that that's a crime of violence, and have also held post-Chamberlain Gaze that a walk away from a halfway house is not.
And I'm just asking you, where do we get the information to distinguish a halfway house from a prison or some other detention facility?
Because it is a type of facility where one can leave with permission.
And we know that because?
In
how many situations?
There are halfway houses where one can leave with permission and then not return. And I can certainly give you that information where there's cases. I did look that up. There are cases where someone has left a halfway house, not returned, and been convicted under a 751.
I understand that, but we're stepping back and say, halfway houses have armed guards? All
some
the
do.
Time, never?
Some
How
do.
Much of the time? You see what kind of analysis?
Exactly.
Where do we get the information to make that kind of informed
It's
judgment?
From the government. Whether the government proves from the documents that...
It's just like burglary. The government can't prove it through documents.
The government can.
No,
to
the court decided burglary presented that risk. Burglary, not
right.
This burglary, that burglary.
Right.
Burglary categorically.
Right.
Is this categorically absconding from a halfway house present that risk or not?
No. And the circuits all of them that have addressed it have held that. No,
that
it does not.
That may be what they said, but I think Judge Owen is getting at something I hadn't thought about, which is how are they saying it?
They are saying...
How are they coming to the conclusion that was easier for the Supreme Court to come to with reference to whatever they chose to have reference to for failure to report? How are these other circuits saying halfway houses stopping at the charged conduct aren't more often than not?
What they're saying is that...
What are they looking at?
They're saying that the conduct itself... Let me go to that real quickly here.
Well,
there we go. They're saying that...
But we don't know from the conduct, and we aren't... You're not telling us least culpable, whatever the expression.
They're saying that a walk away from an unsecured facility does not pose the same potential risk.
I know, but what's their authority for that? That's, I think, what...
Chambers.
And how do we know halfway houses are unsecured facilities? That's just, it's a basic question.
That is something that the courts haven't addressed, with the exception of the Eighth Circuit. Now, the Eighth Circuit said in Parks that a defendant who left a halfway house, and in that case, he pled to running past a guard and through locked doors when they opened to let someone in. And they said that's leaving a secure facility, but they left open, the Eighth Circuit, which is getting ready to do the en banc case, they left open what they called a true walkaway.
And you think the verb abscond answers some of this?
This court has said abscond can be failure to return. Abscond can be failure to appear. They use that word in describing that kind of conduct.
Departure, so not
both.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.